We'll be in the book of Genesis. You can start in Genesis 49. How necessary is it to have leaders? Especially for any group, any unit. Think of families, organizations, businesses, universities, nations. All these different units, all these different groups, we recognize they need leaders. So they have fathers or presidents or CEOs or leaders of some kind. The world knows that. We know that. You need leaders. What does it take to become a leader then? I hope you see the relationship, first of all, between a lesson focusing on leadership in regard to a week focusing on working together. That if indeed we are to work together, we need leaders to do that. So how can I be a leader? Realize, first of all, and I know this can be kind of a cliche thing to say, but it is true, and I think we forget it, that we all lead. Whether we like it or not, we all lead in some sense or another. We may not lead very well, we may not give much attention to our leadership, but we all have some role in leading somebody. Even, think of, for example, just to establish this, then we can move on. Who is the at the bottom rung of all leadership? I'd say children are at the very bottom. They have to submit to everyone else. They are led by everyone else. Everyone else makes the rules for them. But even children influence and lead others. They lead other children, don't they? And so just by saying that, at the bottom rung, children even have a leadership, an example role. They can lead their younger siblings. They can lead their peers. So we all will have to be leaders, whether we like it or not. And so we need to be good leaders. But especially in thinking about the group here and the ways you lead in your family or try to lead in this congregation, not just talking about a worship service, but in other ways, what kind of leader will I be? How am I to lead? How will I learn how to lead? From where will I learn how to lead? Back in Rantoul, where we worship and work, there are no elders right now, and there have not been for several years. But one good thing about the group there, one thing I really appreciate, is that while there are no elders, and we are seeking to have elders one day, there are people who aren't just waiting around for elders to pop up, but they're developing their leadership. They're developing their skills and their ability to lead. How are they doing that? As we observe them, how do we see people developing those things? We need to be developing leaders. This congregation needs elders. But I also want to realize that you may never be an elder. You may be someone who you're a woman, you can't be an elder, or some situation in your life where being an elder is no longer an option for you. But that does not mean that you have no option in leadership. You surely can lead. Genesis chapter 49, verses 8 through 12, God chose a leader. He chose a leader for his people, what would become the nation of Israel. In Genesis 49, Jacob is blessing his sons. And in this blessing, God is really expressing his reward and his punishment and his plans for these tribes that will come from these patriarchs. So Genesis 49, look at 8 through 12. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down, he crouched as a lion, and as a lioness, who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. Binding his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to choice vine, he has washed his garments in wine, and his vesture in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. Judah is God's chosen leader for his people. He's a lion's cub. He is a lion. He shall be praised by his brothers, and he will be the one from whom the scepter will come. Why? Why did God choose Judah? What kind of leadership qualities did he see in this man, Judah? That's our question for tonight, as we see how God makes a leader out of Judah. So turn back to Genesis 37. Genesis 37, we see some initiation on Judah's part. See what kind of leader he has already become. Well, look at verse 25. Of course, Joseph has been looking for his brothers. He has been sent by his father to see how they're doing, what their well-being is. And we know, of course, that they are jealous of him, especially with his recent dreams about him being ruler over them and them bowing before him. They don't want Joseph around. Of course, they betray him. They throw him in a pit and they have plans to kill him. Reuben tries to stop that and wants to return Joseph alive to their father. And so they have this dilemma. And someone is to initiate a plan. We don't want Joseph around, but we also don't want to go so far as to kill him. So what's going to happen? Well, as they're waiting around, Judah thinks of something and he initiates that plan. Verse 25. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our own brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him up out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. So here, Judah initiates. He initiates a plan. He leads. And with what compassion and care that he leads here. What consideration for the people that he is affecting here. Of course not. Of course he is leading selfishly in a way we know he ought not to be leading. In destroying Joseph, and getting rid of Joseph in a way that we don't have to kill him, but at least we can get rid of him. Let's sell him and send him to Egypt with these Ishmaelites. So that's our start for how Judah leads. Obviously not a very good impression. Why in the world is God choosing this man? And especially what I want to do as we look at Judah's story is realize that Judah's story is kind of just speckled here and there among Joseph's story. And the writer, Moses, as he constructed Genesis and as God orchestrated history, they chose to set it up that way and tell us about Judah, tell us about Joseph, tell us about Judah, tell us about Joseph. And there's a contrast and there's a relationship between these stories that we need to appreciate, as it is the Word of God communicating lessons for us and truths for us. So think about this. Judah's leadership is beginning this way. But Joseph, as we saw in his dreams, as we mentioned in his dreams, will become a leader. And we know what kind of leader Joseph will become. And all the while Joseph is becoming this great leader, we're going to see how Judah is wallowing in his own lack of ability to lead. Joseph will arise and lead over Potiphar's household. He'll even be sent to prison, but he'll even overcome that hardship and lead in prison. And the prison will be entrusted to him. And then he'll be taken out of that and he'll be leading over Egypt as if he were Pharaoh himself. And again, we'll see how Judah wallows in his own inability to lead. Chapter 38 then is a chapter that often in the kids' Bible classes we might skip because of its sexual immorality content and because of just what in the world has Joseph popped up in the middle of, or Judah's popped up in the middle of Joseph's story for. But it's very important for us to see. So chapter 38, we'll look at verses 1 and 2 for starters here. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hira. And just a note, that's a man. Verse 2, there Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her. So first of all, he's marrying a Canaanite woman. This is showing poor discretion on Judah's part. In Genesis, it is clear, as you read the book of Genesis, that it's a bad idea for any of Jacob's, or any of the people of promise, the people of the covenant, to marry a Canaanite woman. You have that happening early on. Abraham, when he makes a covenant with his servant, I believe chapter 24, he makes a covenant with his servant to say, don't bring my son back into another area, keep him in the promised land, and do not, and he says it more than once, do not get a wife for my son from the Canaanites. And you see some examples where some of the people, like Esau, did marry Canaanite women, and then he marries an Ishmaelite woman. It's not good to do in Genesis, and it does not please God in Genesis. So there is a first start, that in the one he marries, it shows he has poor discretion. Think about that principle, eldership. It is important what kind of woman an elder marries and what kind of marriage they have. That is a part of the requirements of does he manage his household well? Is he a man who's married to a man of one woman? And so he shows poor discretion in that, in marrying this Canaanite woman. But then look here in verses 6 through 10. As we continue to see his leadership here. And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. And her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring to your brother. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his own. So whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the seed on the ground so as not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord. And he put him to death also. Just so happens that in the qualifications that Paul prescribes for eldership, it is also important as to how an elder raises his children, and whether or not they're faithful, and whether or not he manages them well. How is Judah doing with that? Judah is not very qualified to be an elder. No. His sons are so wicked, he has so little control in how he raised his children, that his sons both grow up to be so wicked that God himself executes them. He is no leader. He can't even lead his own house. And again, meanwhile, Joseph is going to be rising to such power over such responsibility, Judah can't even lead his own family. It's very clear. Let's look at verse 11 to see how he leads in the promise he makes here. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up, for he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. Judah makes a promise. Looks like not very well motive, not like with good motives. But he makes a promise because he's afraid that you can have my next son as he grows up. Will he keep it? Leaders make promises. Good leaders and bad leaders. And many leaders make them in order to get positions of trust, in order to have leadership. But it's the politicians that are known for the kind of leadership that are promises that are not kept, right? But perhaps it's not just politicians. Perhaps it's fathers. Perhaps it's parents. Perhaps it's me. Perhaps it's you. Judah here, I don't think, intends to really keep this. Verses 12 through 19, we'll see how Judah's unkept promise influences Tamar to sin. Verses 12 through 19. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear sheep, she took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said, come, let me come in to you. For he did not know that she was his own daughter-in-law. She said, what will you give me that you may come in to me? And he answered, I will send you a young goat from the flock. And she said, if you give me a pledge until you send it. He said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her and went into her. And she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. I want to notice, especially in verse 14, why Tamar did this. At the end of verse 14, "For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage." What has influenced Tamar to sin but the fact that Judah has not kept his promise? I'm not giving an excuse for Tamar's sin. No, not at all. But it is clear that leaders influence others for good or ill. And here Judah clearly influences her to sin, and even ends up causing himself to sin, to make his sin greater. So that's how he influences. That's how he leads. Instead of leading others for good and for the betterment of their character and things like that, he influences them to sin. Verses 20 through 23. "When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. And he asked the men of the place, 'Where is the cult prostitute who was at a Nahum at the roadside?' And they said, 'No cult prostitute has been here.' So he returned to Judah and said, 'I have not found her.' Also the men of the place said, 'No cult prostitute has been here.' And Judah replied, 'Let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her.'" So he gets himself into sin, and now what does he have to do? He's got to hide it. Okay, this is related to what we talked about on Sunday. He's got to hide it. This cannot be known. If you want to be a leader, if you want to be trusted, you cannot let this kind of thing get out, right? And so he's beginning to let hypocrisy set in, which sadly is a very common characteristic of leadership. Verse 24. "About 3 months later, Judah was told, 'Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality.' And Judah said, 'Bring her out and let her be burned.'" So here his hypocrisy comes to completion. Is he in hiding his own sin, not even knowing that he is very closely related to the sin of this woman? Let her be burned. Hypocrisy is a great temptation for leaders, for preachers, for elders, for fathers, for parents. Hypocrisy is such a strong temptation because we want to be trusted. We want a position of leadership, whether it be to control or whether it be for the good of the others. And we'll do it even if it means concealing our sin, perpetuating our sin, hiding our sin. And so Judah is indeed like many leaders we see, like leading perhaps that we have done. Why did God choose him? Again, meanwhile, Joseph, who received ill treatment from Judah, is going to become ruler of Egypt. Look at chapter 39, just glance. You'll recognize it. Joseph is falsely accused by Potiphar's wife. Here, Joseph has been rising up from a slave to a respected and trusted servant as manager over the whole household of Potiphar. And you know what this is an opportunity for? An opportunity to sleep with Potiphar's wife is not just a pleasure thing, but it's an opportunity to make a statement of power and influence. That's what that is. That's what that is today often, and it was very much back then. To sleep with someone else's wife is to make a statement about your control, your authority, your influence. Joseph does not choose to lead or to gain a position in that way. And by not choosing to do that, he ends up losing his position. And so see the contrast. As Judah wallows in his sin, he can't even lead his own family. And yet perhaps, in the next verses here, 25 and 26, we see perhaps the first step of what begins to make Judah a leader in God's eyes, a good leader. Verse 25, "As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, "By the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant." And she said, "Please, identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff." The eunuch identified them and said, "She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Sheila, and he did not know her again." Humility and owning up to your sin does not in itself qualify anyone for leadership. That's true. But you cannot be a leadership for God, a leader for God, unless you have humility, unless you have openness. He begins to do that. You might think, well, he had to by this point. It's become very clear, very obvious, but you know what? It can become very clear and obvious to everyone else, but hypocrisy can take us further and further to greater denial. He does fess up, and other people don't always do that. Even when it becomes like as if, come on, you can't lie anymore, they continue to deny it. So he finally here is confessing his sin, recognizing it. He's being humble. Just an interesting parallel, and I don't want to spend too much time thinking about it, but Judah, we might think he's just gone too far. He's too far gone. He can never be a leader for God. Remember who comes from Judah? What great king comes from Judah? Well, that's David. David comes from Judah, and he was a man after God's own heart, right? But there's a very similar story we have with David. In 2 Samuel 11 and 12, he sins, and he sins greatly. And he tries to hide his sin. And he is a hypocrite about it. And he says, when he's told about this story about a man who takes another man's sheep, when he had a whole wealth of sheep, he says, that person ought to be killed for that. The same kind of hypocrisy you see of Judah. Remember, David does the same that Judah does. And we have more detail from David. He confesses when it's brought to him. He humbles himself. He turns around. He repents. Every leader is a sinner on earth. And no leader is perfectly adequate on his own. Who makes anyone adequate for anything? Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 3. I'm afraid that sometimes churches don't have elders because they view the commandment about elders as simply don't ever appoint someone who's unqualified. That is not how we're taught about elders. Instead, it's appoint qualified men. See the positive direction of that? But too often our attitude is don't appoint unqualified men. And so we approach it with the attitude that says if they have any imperfection, if they've ever had a bout of a bad temperament, if they've ever had anything like that, one instance disqualifies them. Who makes a leader adequate? In 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 4 through 6, Paul is speaking about apostleship and what makes anyone adequate for such a role. Such is the confidence that we have through Christ toward God. Not that we are sufficient in ourselves to claim anything as coming from us, but our sufficiency is from God, who has made us competent to be ministers of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. Paul was not an adequate leader for Christ in the church, but God turned him around. God changed him. God transformed him, and God made him into a leader. Christ made him into a leader. And so someone as far gone as Judah can become a leader. I'm not saying, I want to be clear, I'm not saying that you don't have to follow the qualifications of eldership to be an elder. That's not at all what I'm saying. We need to appoint qualified men. But there are leadership roles that we can have whether we're elders or not. And God can make us into leaders. Paul was not a man who was qualified to be elders. It just so happens. But back to Genesis. Consider Judah, the fourth born. Why is the fourthborn the one who's chosen to lead the people of God? We know in that culture, and especially in a patriarchal society, it is the firstborn who gets the birthright, who gets the double blessing, who gets the opportunity to be that leadership role. Why doesn't Reuben get to lead? Why doesn't Simeon get to lead? Why doesn't Levi get to lead? Why does God choose Judah instead? Well, let's look. As you wonder, will Judah be the leader? Will Reuben, will Simeon, will Levi be the leader? Who will be the leader? Consider Genesis 35. As you see early on how Reuben leads. Genesis 35, verse 22. Very short, quick thing here. While Israel lived in that land, that is Jacob, Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. Do you think Reuben slept with his father's concubine, the mother of his brothers, because of sexual attraction? That's possible. But I think it's much more likely that the main idea here is exactly what I talked about with Joseph, that he has an opportunity to try to gain an upper hand on his other brothers, an upper hand even on his father, by sleeping with his father's concubine. It makes a statement of influence and power. That's how Reuben will lead. Because that's how they do it around him. That's how the world around him has taught him to lead, and he has learned it. How about Simeon and Levi, chapter 34? They have stopped on their way back into the promised land. They have stopped at Shechem and begun living there by Jacob's leadership. And they begin to be influenced by the men of Shechem and the people of Shechem. Dinah is defiled by one of the men of Shechem, one of the leading men there. And they want to intermarry. The people of Shechem want to intermarry with Jacob and his sons and his family. But they don't want to marry uncircumcised people. And so here's the deal they come up with. Verses 13 through 17. The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we agree with you, that you will become as we are by every male among you being circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to ourselves, and we will dwell with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we will be gone." That's like a reasonable deal. They're concerned about the covenant and they want them to be circumcised. Well, we won't read the rest actually, but clearly what ends up happening, if you remember the story, you can glance down. They answered them deceitfully because the whole idea was that when they are in the midst of their pain of circumcision, I believe it's the third day here, they turn and Simeon and Levi go in and they slaughter every man among them. It's important for a leader to be just. It's important for a leader to be able to lead his people in battle and to execute judgment. And so you might see Simeon and Levi as leaders, as bringing justice and vengeance. But in what way have they done this? Is it justice? Death in the old covenant, which they're not a part of yet, in the law of Moses, is required for adultery. Yes. But the death of the guilty, not the death of everyone who's related to him. And so they take their idea of vengeance, their idea of justice, and execute it. This is how they lead. They take it into their own hands, and they end up creating even greater injustice than was already done to them. So this is how they lead. How does God view that? Chapter 49, again, where Jacob is giving the blessings to his people, to his sons. Chapter 49, verses 3 through 7. Jacob says of Reuben, "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the firstfruits of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power." You see that? He's a leader. He's powerful. powerful. He has dignity. He has strength. He's the first fruits. These are all kinds of words we want to describe for a leader. But verse 4, unstable as water. You shall not have preeminence because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. That one verse back in chapter 35 has this kind of importance. That Jacob and to God, because you chose to lead like that, you will not have preeminence. And then Simeon and Levi are grouped together in the blessing, just as they were grouped together back in chapter 34. Verse 5, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Stop there. Many of us in here are probably Republicans. And if the Republican mind is often, and the Republican platform is often, right, we're the hawkish ones, right, for Republicans. We're the ones who are all about funding war. So leadership, to us, it's important for leadership, for Republican mind, to have violence and swords. Leaders and kings, they do judge. They do bring justice. But again, verse 6. Let my soul come not into their counsel. O my glory, be not joined to their company. For in their anger, they killed men. In their willfulness, they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And so governments, they do need to execute justice, but there needs to be justice. How many times in the Old Testament does God have governments come and execute justice? Babylon, for example. But then they go beyond what God willed. And they demonstrate their kind of justice, just like Levi and Simeon do. We got to be careful as we support a government that does perhaps go beyond what God is seeking in justice. But I'm not here to talk about politics. What about our families? What about parents? Most Christians I know do believe that spanking is important. But you know why spanking became such a bad idea to our culture? Yes, of course we do. Because there was abuse, and there is abuse, and it's all over. And so while we might pride ourselves in being disciplinarians, let's be disciplinarians, not abusive. And we need to apply this in all our areas of life. It is easy to do. It's easy to become angry in our justice instead of letting God guide our justice. And so Reuben and Simeon and Levi, they lose it. They don't get to be leaders. God chooses someone else. But still we haven't quite answered. Besides the fact that Judah has become humble, besides the fact that Judah has confessed his sin, we haven't really answered why God chooses Judah. And so let's consider chapter 39. Oh, sorry, not chapter 39. Back to, excuse me, chapter 42. So like I said, the story of Joseph dominates this section. And Judah's kind of both ends here. Chapter 39, 40, 41. It's been about Joseph. There's been no mention of Judah. Joseph has been leading in Egypt. He's been gaining power and influence and been using it to be a blessing to even all the world and to his own people. And in chapter 42, Judah and his brothers and his father come back into the picture because there's a famine and they need to survive. So they go to Egypt, and of course Joseph wants to find out about Benjamin, his brother, his full brother, and he wants to find about Jacob, his father. Are they alive? Are they well? And he wants to see them. The test is to bring Benjamin back, and of course he's going to test them more. And he tests them in making Benjamin look like he's guilty. Remember, he puts the money back in their sacks. He puts the cup, his silver cup, in Benjamin's bag without them knowing. And as they go down the line, they all claim, we don't have it. We didn't take it. We didn't take anything. And anyone, if you find any of us as having anything, you can take us as a slave for you. And they find Benjamin with it. And all the brothers say, no, don't take Benjamin. And they say, take us all. Take us all as slaves. And they say, no. Joseph says, no, I'll take Benjamin. I'll require it of him. He's the guilty one. So with all of that context, Judah approaches Joseph. Chapter 42, verse 36. I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong spot here. I have jumped ahead, that's my problem. Excuse me. I've jumped ahead. Let's back up, back to Jacob. When they've gone back to Jacob, they're going to ask Jacob for Benjamin. We need to bring Benjamin back. Joseph asked for Benjamin. I apologize for jumping ahead. We need to bring Benjamin back. How will Jacob finally be convinced to bring Benjamin back? Well, chapter 42, verse 36 here. Reuben approaches Jacob. And Jacob, their father, said to them, you have bereaved me of my children, Joseph. Children, Joseph is no more, Simeon is no more, and now you would take Benjamin. All this has come against me. Then Reuben said to his father, kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you. Look at Jacob's offer here. Reuben's offer here. Reuben's offer, and the way he's going to convince, persuade his father, this is how he's going to lead, is I know, you can trust me, if I don't bring Benjamin back alive, you can kill my two sons. What does that say about his commitment here? It means he values his own life more than that of his sons. If he's not willing to commit himself, then that means when it comes to it, when it's Benjamin's life or Reuben's life, which is he going to choose? And so it does not convince Jacob. Jacob does not. He's not persuaded by that. But then, in the next chapter, chapter 43, starting verse 1, we'll see Judah's offer. Now the famine was severe in the land, and when they had eaten the grain that they had brought from Egypt, their father said to them, go again, buy us a little food. But Judah said to him, the man solemnly warned us, saying, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you will send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down, for the man said to us, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. Israel said, why did you treat me so badly as to tell the man that you had another brother? They replied, the man questioned us carefully about ourselves and our kindred, saying, is your father still alive? Do you have another brother? What we told him was an answer to these questions. Could we in any way know that he would say, bring your brother down? And Judah said to his father, send the boy with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I will be a pledge of safety. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. If we had not delayed, we would now have returned twice. Do you see the contrast? Reuben offers the life of his two sons, one that he may not even keep. But Judah, he offers himself. That's the way he commits himself. So that when it becomes a choice between Benjamin and his own life, he is claiming that he will choose Benjamin's life. He'll make that great of a commitment. But of course, is his pledge to protect Benjamin just like his pledge to give Tamar his son later? Does Judah have any intention to keep this? And so that's what brings us to the test that is completed with Joseph and his brothers. Chapter 44, verse 18. That's where Benjamin is in a compromised situation. And Benjamin, his life and his future is at risk. And Judah then stands up to protect him. Verse 18 of chapter 44. Then Judah went up to him and said, oh, my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's ear, and let not your anger burn against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself. My Lord asked his servants, saying, have you a father or a brother? And we said to my Lord, we have a father, an old man, and a young brother, the child of his old age. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes on him. We said to my Lord, the boy cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. Then you said to your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall not see my face again. So Judah's retelling all of this. This is the situation. This is the kind of difficult situation you have put us in. 24. When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my Lord. And when our father said, go again, buy us a little food, we said, we cannot go down. If our youngest brother goes with us, then we will go down, for we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. And your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. One left me, and I said, surely he has been torn to pieces, and I have never seen him since. If you take this one also from me, and harm happens to him, he will bring down my gray hairs, even to Sheol. Verse 30. Now therefore, as soon as I come to your servant, my father, and the boy is not with us, then as his life is bound up in the boy's life, as soon as he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die. And your servants will bring down the gray hairs of your servant, our father, with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life. Now therefore, please, let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my Lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father. I want to read all of that because I want us to see that Judah, he tries to show Joseph the kind of difficult situation he's put them in. But then he also shows Joseph the kind of care he has for his father. If we go back there, we're going to bring his hair down to Sheol. He's going to die if we go back there and don't have Benjamin. And then he also shows his commitment. Not just naming the commitment, but demonstrating it here. As Judah puts his life in the place of Benjamin. I want you to realize what he's done here. I want you to think about this. Benjamin appears to have stolen the ruler's cup, Joseph's cup. They don't know it's Joseph, remember? It appears that Benjamin's guilty. As far as Judah knows, he's just acting like a spoiled, untrustworthy brat who just takes other people's things without any discretion. And he needs to repay with slavery. Judah is approaching a man who has the authority of Pharaoh. That is no simple, easy task. Just that in itself is risking himself. Just by approaching him. Look at the way he talks when he approaches him. Oh, my Lord, please, let your servant speak a word in my Lord's ear, and let not your anger burn against your servant. For you are like Pharaoh himself. Do you see how it's emphasized? He is coming, approaching, making a big request to this man who's already been offended by his family. So he goes before this man. He risks himself and lays himself down for the sake of someone who looks like a sinner, who looks like he's guilty. He takes the penalty of Benjamin for Benjamin's sake. Sound like anything? This is why I believe God has chosen Judah as the leader. And why such great men as David come from Judah. And why God has brought our Messiah from Judah. Because in Judah we have a picture of someone who's transformed from being a wicked, selfish, incompetent man. He's transforming into someone who's devoting himself. He's committed to his promises. And he's giving himself up. For even someone who doesn't look like they deserve it, is giving himself up. He is serving, and he is leading, and he is sacrificing as Christ, as his future offspring would do in saving the whole world. So this sheds light on us, for us, for our leadership. Judah helps us understand what Christ has done, and what Christ has done helps us understand what we need to do. As we lead, we cannot manipulate or domineer in any leadership role. Husbands, parents, elders, and so on. We cannot use the worldly ways of our day-to-day relationship, of our culture, to get on top, to get the positions of authority, whether it be in our jobs, in other realms of life, our families, or in God's church, God's body of believers. Self-promotion, politicking, bribing, manipulating, this has no place in the kingdom of God. So while not doing that, the only way that we can really do that, I could have just presented this as a lesson and just come and told you this rule, don't manipulate, serve sacrificially. I could have just said it as a moral code for everybody. But God doesn't just give us a moral code to follow. He gives us a demonstration of His love for us, that we don't have to just keep on giving and giving and giving. But we have a leader who has done that for us. I think about the love bank language that is often used in marriage books, that so long as you keep each other's love banks filled, then you can keep on serving each other. As if I can't serve you until you give me something, and then I can give you something. I know it's not always used that way, but if that were all it was, if that were the whole picture, it would not work. Because I can't keep on leading like that. I can't keep on serving like that. I can't keep on putting myself out like that. I will be drained. I will be broken. I will be depressed. I will be downtrodden. I cannot do that. I will run dry. Unless someone else is filling me up. Unless someone who is so good and so wonderful that I am overflowing. So that even if the ones I'm leading, even if my wife doesn't give anything in return, even if my children don't give anything in return, even if the congregation doesn't give anything in return, I can still keep on giving because my King, my Lord, my Father has given Himself up completely. I have no excuse. Not at all. He fills me up. I'm overflowing. And the more we realize that, the more then we can say, I know I need to sacrifice. I know I need to serve. I know I need to lead with humility. Because if we just try to do it as a code or as a rule, we'll never be able to maintain it. But our Lord will fill us up, enable us to do so. As He did for Judah, He can do for us. So I'm not expecting that any of us are adequate in ourselves to lead. No, we're not. But if God can make Judah into a leader, then He can make each of us into the kind of leader that He seeks. One more passage. Mark chapter 10. As Jesus describes this, just the way that I'm trying to express to you. Mark 10. James and John. They were just told, according to the Luke account, that they will reign on 12 thrones with Jesus in the kingdom. And in Matthew's account, we learn that their mother kind of is apparently prompting them to do this, to get the position, a higher position. And James and John, now in Mark, they come to Jesus, their brothers, and they're seeking a position on Jesus' right and left in the kingdom. And their idea of the kingdom and of rulership and leadership is going to look a lot more like Reuben's idea and Simeon and Levi's idea than Christ's idea. And more like the world's idea. And Jesus is saying, you think you can handle that? You think you can drink the cup that I'm going to drink? You think you can be immersed in the immersion in which I'm going to be immersed? He's talking about the cross. He's talking about that kind of leadership. That's the kind of thing they're called to. And they say, we can't. And Jesus gathers them all together because all the other disciples are feeling indignant toward them. Indignant toward James and John, which only proves, of course, that they want the same kind of position that they want, that James and John want. And so verse 42, Jesus gathers them together and says, you know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all, for even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give His life as a ransom for many. So again, I could have just read this passage and give a message clearly. But I want you to realize, it uses some of the same ideas that what God demonstrated in Judah. He, even the Son of Man, gave Himself a ransom for many. Isn't that exactly what Judah did? What God brought Judah to do? So that gives us a good picture and a good story to see how God really works that. And how He really did that in His Son. He's a ransom for many. Only He's not like Judah exactly, because Judah sacrificed for a man who looked guilty. Jesus sacrifices, He gives Himself as a ransom for people who are so guilty. And so this is how to lead. Not lording it over. Not domineering, not just to control. And so this is for you as a group, And it's for you and your families and for me to lead as God has led. But something good I think about when we consider these kinds of principles is if there's anyone who's from the community or doesn't know Christ, but also for every one of us who do, our culture has defamed authority so much. Because, you know what? They've been proven right so much. And so the idea of authority of a man over a woman is a very bad idea in our culture. And the idea of giving discipline that involves spanking and a rod is a very bad idea in our culture. And the idea of a king versus a democracy is a very bad idea in our culture. And why is that? Because over and over again, it's been proven to them that people in power abuse their subjects. And they use their authority, when it comes to it, for their own use, for their own pleasure, for their own goals, and their own will. And so it looks like they're right. It looks like our culture is right. But the wonderful thing for the world to see, and for all of us to see, and to worship our God for, is that He has shown us that dominion never had that purpose. Authority never had that purpose. And we need a king. We do not know what's best for ourselves. We cannot lead ourselves. We cannot bring ourselves justice and righteousness on our own. God knows what's best for us. And He doesn't lead us for our own good. And you know how we know that? We know that. It's been proven to us because He serves us and He leads us not just with a rod, but with a cross. Don't you love God for that? Don't we want to share that? Well, then let's live it and prove it.